Yep. Okay, cool. What did we do? We have no idea.
I connected to something.
Okay. That's funny.
I thought you'd be on the
I haven't checked it. I don't think I'm using it today, actually. I don't remember, though. Okay. What do we do with, we lost both screens.
PC was for that one, then dock. So PC is what we're going to do, the laptop.
Okay. And so now laptop.
I'm sorry, the laptop. PC's got laptop.
Okay, great. Okay. I think we have a couple of people who are going to do their take-aparts. Let's start with that. I know we have at least one group.
Finally got the camera
applied.
Oh, cool. Okay, there you go.
Thanks. The doctor's camera on? Yes.
So we actually started with this kid camera, and it was actually very difficult to break in half, but we finally got it by breaking it down the middle, and we had to pry out the battery case. And this top half is the lens where you can cover it, and you can see it sliding back and forth here. And then this controls the flash on and off, and there's actually the metal strip back here. And
okay. So I'm going to go into a little more detail on the inside. We have just basic camera functionality here. We have an advance and the winding. The battery casing used to go here before we threw it on the floor 5 times and broke it in half. What we have right here is the flash assembly with all the electronics that are needed. And the cool thing is that you can actually see right here the metal piece that goes up to meet the flash and is then pressed down by the button to make it flash. So basically from the electronics we have this, which would go down to the broken battery casing to provide the power for the flash. And yeah, that's the rest of it's just the assembly for holding all the film, and so the advance turns it and moves the film across this little divide, just like a regular camera. So it's more or less what we've got.
All right, so today we're going to continue on with Unit 3, and we're going to transition and begin to talk about cancer. And as we talk about cancer, we're going to pay particular attention to early detection of cancer. And so what I want to do today is I want to go into a little bit more detail about the epidemiology and the pathophysiology of cancer. And then in the next three lectures, we're going to talk about three particular types of cancer and go into much more detail about those types of cancer. So last time we talked about ethics of research involving human subjects, the three principles of the Belmont Report, which are respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. And we talked about how it's important for subjects who are involved in clinical research to give informed consent, which basically means that they understand the purpose of the study, they understand the methods of the study, and they understand the possible benefits that might come to them and the possible risks that they might undertake as well. We saw that video from Dr. Zwelling, who used to be the head of the IRB at MD Anderson. And one of the things that he emphasized was that informed consent is a process. It's not just a document. Okay, is Christina here today? Yes, did you want to mention a little bit about the event? Okay, so it's 12 p.m. on Monday at the Baker Institute. Okay, cool. So what I want to talk about today then is focusing in on how technology can solve healthcare problems, looking at early detection of cancer. We selected three cancers to talk about in this unit. We selected cervical cancer, we selected prostate cancer, and we selected ovarian cancer, and we chose them for important reasons. Cervical cancer, as you will see in class on Tuesday, is a cancer that we basically know how to prevent. We have the technology available to us to completely prevent cervical cancer, yet more than 250,000 women die every year as a result of cervical cancer, because we don't use resources to implement technologies that already exist. And so we'll be looking at why that happens and how newer technologies may be able to address that problem. We chose prostate cancer because it's a good example of a cancer where we have a screening test. It's probably not the most highly effective screening test that exists for cancer. And probably we waste resources testing for prostate cancer with this test. So it's an example of a test that's available that probably is overly used. And so we'll talk about how that happens and some new tests that may improve the performance of prostate cancer screening. And then finally, we chose ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer is a good example of a disease where we desperately need better screening tools. We don't have any good screening tools for ovarian cancer, similar to lung cancer in that regard. And so as a result, women who are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, most of them are diagnosed when their cancer is at stage 3 or stage 4, when we don't have very effective treatments. So the 5-year survival rate for ovarian cancer is very, very low because we just don't have good tools to detect it early. And so we're going to take a day and we're going to talk about each of those cancers. Today, what I want to do, though, is more general. I want to do two things. I want to give you a little bit more information about the epidemiology and the pathophysiology of cancer. And then I want to talk about how we judge the efficacy of a screening test. And so we're going to learn how to calculate a number of quantities. They're called sensitivity and specificity, and positive and negative predictive value. And they're very important when you're assessing how well a screening or a diagnostic test works. Okay? So we're basically right here in that map of Unit 3 that we talked about. So today what I'll talk about is the burden of cancer, how does cancer develop, why is it so crucially important that we have good early detection,
And then we'll look at some strategies for early detection, and then we'll get into our example technologies. So if we look in the United States, cancer is the second leading cause of death in the U.S. It's just behind heart disease. About a quarter of all deaths in the United States are a result of cancer. If we look at the five-year survival rate for all cancers combined, it's just over 60%. It varies tremendously, though, when we look at different types of cancers. For example, for prostate cancer, it's actually fairly high. For ovarian and lung cancer, it's quite low. Cancer is important not only just in terms of the human suffering and loss of life perspective, it's also important from an economic perspective. We spend over $170 billion every year in the U.S. as a result of cancer. Part of this is just direct medical cost, about $60 billion just to take care of people who have cancer. And then we also lose productivity due to illness and due to premature death. If we look in the United States, there are over a million new cases of cancer each year. Just in the state of Texas alone, there are almost 100,000 new cases of cancer each year. About 500,000 deaths in the United States each year due to cancer. Cancer.org has a brochure called Cancer Facts and Figures, which is a really, really great overview of different types of cancers, a little bit of information about the clinical facts that are relevant about each and the epidemiology as well. This is looking at mortality data in the United States, and this was data from 2001. And so we can see at that time, as is still the case this year, heart disease was the leading cause of death. And what's happened is that heart disease has come down a little bit, and the differential between cancer and heart disease has been decreasing with time. Okay, here we're looking at the estimated number of cases of cancer in the United States. This is data from the American Cancer Society, and we've got men on this side of the graph, we've got women on this side of the graph. And so this is looking at number of cases. And you can see that for men, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men in the United States, followed by lung cancer and colorectal cancer. For women, breast cancer is the most common, followed by lung cancer, colorectal. And I put a red box around prostate cancer, number one in terms of cases in men, and I put a box around ovarian cancer here, which is number five for women. And what we're going to look at in the next slide is estimated cancer deaths. Okay, so even though prostate cancer is responsible for the most cases, lung cancer is number two, when we look at deaths, they flip. Lung cancer is number one, prostate cancer is number two. And this has a lot to do with the fact that we screen for prostate cancer and we don't have good screening tools for lung cancer. And when we look at ovarian cancer, it's responsible for only 4% of cancer cases in women, but it's responsible for 6% of cancer deaths in women. Again, because we don't have good screening tools, so when it's detected, it tends to be fairly advanced and our therapies aren't very effective. Okay. Now these are data, these are a decade old. These are data from the WHO. And I think it's really interesting to look at the data from a decade ago. We looked at similar data from 2004 at the beginning of class. And here what we're doing is we're looking at causes of death. Here's cancer right here. 12% of deaths worldwide at this time were caused by cancer. You can see infectious disease is right here, one-third of deaths. And then heart disease is right here, about a third of deaths. So what has happened in the intervening 10 years? Infectious diseases have come down a little bit, and then more chronic diseases of older age, like cancer and heart disease, are becoming more and more important. It's interesting here, if we look at peri and neonatal deaths, they're almost comparable, more than half of what we see due to cancer. This is now breaking things down by developed countries and developing countries. Developed are shown in yellow. And you can see here's cancer, here's heart disease, here's infectious disease. Okay, and here's peri and neonatal mortality. Okay, so in developing countries, peri and neonatal mortality are on really the same order of magnitude as deaths due to cancer. All right, if we look at the worldwide burden of cancer, there are 11 million new cases of cancer in the world every year, about 6 million deaths. A third of these could be prevented. Okay, if we eliminated tobacco usage, if we implemented screening techniques that we have, that we know are effective, and if people made changes in their diet and changes in their lifestyle, a third of these cancers could be prevented. If we look at projections for what is estimated to happen by 2020, it's estimated that we'll go from 11 million new cases to 15 million new cases, from 6 million deaths to 10 million deaths, and that these changes are predominantly due to two factors: aging of the population and increase in smoking rates. Okay. Almost a fourth of cancers are caused by infectious agents. So for example, we saw how hepatitis can lead to liver cancers. Infection with the human papilloma virus is the cause of cervical cancer. We'll look at that in class on Tuesday. And H. pylori is involved in the pathogenesis of cancers of the stomach. And so vaccination could be very important in preventing these cancers. And you may have seen a lot of press about the vaccine to prevent HPV infection. And that's one of the things we'll talk about in class on Tuesday. Okay, and so here I've just highlighted in red a number of the cancers that are associated with infectious agents. And you can see it's a large number of worldwide cases that are associated with infectious agents. Okay, so if we take a look at the pathophysiology of cancer, even though it's a heterogeneous group of diseases, they're basically all characterized by uncontrolled cell growth and the spread of these what are called neoplastic cells. It can be caused both by external factors, carcinogens like tobacco or other chemicals, radiation or infectious organisms, as well as internal factors like mutations, hormones, and particularly conditions that depress the response of the immune system. The vast majority of cancers arise in epithelial tissues. About 85% of cancers arise in the epithelial linings, like the skin, the lining of your digestive tract, the lining of reproductive organs. And so I've got a cartoon here that shows the squamous epithelium. This is a particular kind of squamous epithelium. It's called a stratified squamous epithelium. The lining of the cervix, the lining of the inside of the mouth looks very much like this, and skin is not so dissimilar from this as well. Basically, you've got the outer surface of the tissue, and then you've got epithelial cells beneath that. Remember that one of the ways that your immune system protects you is by having this barrier of dead cells at the surface of the skin. And so that would be these cells right here. And you can see those cells are kind of flattened, and they've got very small nuclei. Those cells are, in many cases, dead or about to die. They are not metabolically active. They are not reproducing. They're terminally differentiated. As we go down through the epithelium, typical thickness of this epithelium might be 300 microns, which is maybe twice the diameter of a human hair. As we go down, we see that the ratio of the size of the nucleus to the cytoplasm, it's called the nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio, increases. These cells are much less differentiated than these cells. They're metabolically active, they are actively dividing, and they are what are responsible for regenerating the epithelium. Mm-hmm. It really varies from organ site to organ site. In the cervix, for example, there's typically at least a couple hundred microns of mucus sitting on top here. It also varies with cycle there. So this again is about 300 microns thick, and then we have a basement membrane, which is basically a layer of collagen that these cells are going to sit on top of. Underneath that, we have connective tissue that contains structural proteins like collagen and elastin. It also contains fibroblasts that will make that collagen, and it contains blood vessels. The way that these cells will get their nutrients, part of it will be just oxygen diffusion from the air up here, and part of it will be diffusion from the capillaries that are located in this connective tissue. But there aren't any blood vessels in the epithelium. There are just cells in the epithelium. Okay? So this is what the normal epithelium looks like. What happens when a cancer begins to develop is you go through a sequence called the precancer to cancer sequence. Okay? And here we have a cartoon of our normal epithelium. And we've got this gradient of differentiation of these cells throughout the epithelium. These cells are dead, dying, terminally differentiated. These are the least differentiated, most metabolically active, most rapidly dividing cells. And that's what the normal epithelium looks like. Now, when we have a precancer begin to form, we will have a transformation in some of the cells that are present here, and it happens at the bottom of the epithelium. And when those cells become transformed, they will then begin to divide in a way such that you end up with progressively more and more and more and more of that epithelium filled with these less differentiated, metabolically active cells that are characterized by a large nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio. You also see how within a layer, the shape and the size of the cells is very consistent in normal tissue. You've got it's homogeneous in the lateral direction. But now, over here, we've got what's called pleomorphism. Pleomorphism means there's just a lot of variations in the shape and the size, both of the cells and of the nuclei. As we go from here to here to here to here, it's still a precancerous lesion. It's not a cancer yet. When it becomes a cancer, what happens is these cells, which are only supposed to be in the epithelium, break through the basement membrane and they get in to the supporting stroma beneath. And you can see that that's happened here. And this would be called microinvasion. Okay, these cancer cells acquire the ability to invade in to other tissues where they're not supposed to be. So we would call, I'll get to that in just a little bit. So it's not a metastasis yet, and that's an important distinction, and I'll define what a metastasis is in about. So it's still in one organ site right now. It's still in the organ site where it took its origin. So let's imagine that it was on the inside of the cheek. Okay? And so we've got our precancerous cells in the epithelium there. When they go in to the supporting stroma underneath, it's still on the cheek, that's called microinvasion. If it goes to another organ site, maybe it goes into the bone of the jaw, that's a metastasis. Okay? All right, so this on the left would be normal tissue. These four panels in the middle would be called precancer, and this E, panel E right here, is a special kind of lesion. It's called a carcinoma in situ. It's not a cancer, but what it means is that that whole thickness of the epithelium is filled with these precancerous epithelial cells. Now, when they break through the basement membrane and I've got a microinvasion, we go from precancer to cancer. And the difference for the patient is really, really important because basically we can cure precancer. There are very simple therapies where basically we just cut it out and the cure rates are 100%. When we have microinvasion, the prognosis and the invasiveness of the therapy is going to, we're going to get much more invasive and we're going to be much more worried that our therapy may not be curative. Okay? Now, I was showing you a cartoon before. This is an actual photograph. These are photographs of the cervix. Here's the surface of the cervical epithelium. Here's the whole epithelial thickness. These cells right here sit on top of the basement membrane. This is the normal cervix on the left. And you can see this gradient of differentiation amongst these cells. Now, we're looking at what's called a high-grade cervical precancer. It's a precancer because I've got a clear epithelium and I've got a clear stroma down here. But it's a precancer because within that epithelium, it's basically filled with these precancerous cells that are characterized by big nuclei, lots of variations in the shape. Over here they look kind of spindly, over here they look more round. Okay. Now, those precancerous cells are metabolically active. They're dividing, they need a blood supply. One of the things that they're going to do is they are going to recruit the formation of new blood vessels in a process called angiogenesis. And so if we've got this nest of tumor cells, they are going to recruit the formation of new blood vessels. And that process, again, is known as angiogenesis. The vessels that form in this angiogenesis process are different than normal blood vessels in a number of ways. They'll have this very tortuous sort of 3D distribution of blood vessels. And they're also leakier blood vessels than normal blood vessels would be. So as we go from precancer to a microinvasive cancer, the main thing that happens is we've got our epithelial cells sitting on top of the basement membrane. When we get microinvasion, what happens is they migrate into the stroma. Now we've got a cancer. They begin to grow in the organ site where the cancer initially formed. They're recruiting the formation of new blood vessels. Okay? And one of the things that these tumor cells can do is they can extravasate into the bloodstream. They can do the same thing into the lymphatic vessels. And so the main ways that cancer cells spread is by what's called hematogenous spread, or spread through the blood vessels, or by lymphatic spread, by spreading through the lymphatic vessels that are present in the organ. And so you form little, what are called emboli. They're basically just clusters of tumor cells. And they can spread through the blood vessels. They can arrest on the wall of the blood vessels downstream. They can migrate out, and that is a metastasis. So in a metastasis, we get tumor cells moving from the primary tumor, that's where it started, down here to a secondary site. Okay. I think this cartoon basically just shows the same thing. Here's our nest of tumor cells. It's recruiting the formation of these new blood vessels, and then we get the spread. They squeeze into the blood vessels, or they squeeze into the lymphatics, and then they can metastasize to lymph nodes. Remember we saw how important that was in breast cancer on the very first day of class? Or they can spread through the circulatory system and then get out and form a tumor at a secondary site. Okay. We took a look at a real picture of normal epithelium and precancerous epithelium. The first example that we looked at was from the cervix. This is from the oral cavity. This is the lining of the cheek. And the lining of the cheek is a little bit thicker. Here's the surface. So it's that part right there. This is the surface of that. This is about 400 to 500 microns thick. This is a millimeter for scale. And here now is the basement membrane. You get these ridges. They're called reedy ridges. So it's sort of an undulating basement membrane here. That's the normal oral mucosa. Okay. This is precancer right here. So I've still got a recognizable epithelium, but I no longer have that gradient of differentiation. See how big the nuclei are down here? Much smaller up there. I no longer have that same gradient of differentiation. And what's this? This is right next to that. This is a cancer. Okay, in a cancer, I don't have my nice epithelium sitting on top of my stroma with the epithelial cells in the epithelium and the structural proteins and the blood vessels in the stroma. Now I've just got this mess of everything. I've got tumor cells kind of growing together. I've got stroma here. I've got blood vessels here. I've got a blood vessel here. I've got, this is the surface lining of this tumor. And so I've just completely lost that organization that I had in the normal tissue. And when we talk about tumors, we're going to talk about the degree of differentiation of the tumor. And basically, you can have well-differentiated tumors, you can have moderately differentiated tumors, or poorly differentiated tumors. And if I have a well-differentiated tumor, I'll have areas where the tumor tries to recapitulate the normal tissue. It tries to make areas of epithelium. It tries to make areas of stroma. And so you'll have what looks like, here's a bit of epithelium, here's a bit of stroma. In a poorly differentiated tumor, you've just got a mix of everything, and it's just a mess of tumor cells and intervening stroma. Typically, patients who have poorly differentiated tumors have a much worse prognosis than patients who have moderate or well-differentiated tumors. And again, this is just another cartoon sort of showing that process of metastasis. This is a photo of metastasis. Here we're looking at the liver, and you can see these nodules of tumor cells present throughout the liver. Okay, any questions about the pathobiology of cancer formation? For solid tumors, the process really is amazingly similar from site to site. The reason that the prognosis is worse is that it's just a marker of a more aggressive type of tumor cell. I said that some of the more well-differentiated tumors will try and recapitulate that host structure. And so those tumors, the tumor cells, will have less ability to invade into surrounding areas, in particular to metastasize either through the lymph or through the circulatory system. And so it just tends to be a slower growing, has less metastatic capability.
Mm-hmm. And it was talking about when the cancer cells start to reproduce, but are we still thinking of it as like a normal cell that is mutated, or is it outside that comes in?
It can be either, but typically it's felt that most tumors arise from what's called clonal expansion of a single progenitor cell. And so you're going to have a mutation or a series of mutations. Those can be mutations that are hereditary or result from exposure to carcinogens in the environment or a combination of both. But typically you will get the expansion of the single progenitor cell. As that expansion occurs, there may be additional mutations which are acquired that give the tumor more aggressive capabilities. The other thing that can happen is when you treat a tumor, an advanced tumor, when you treat it with radiation or you treat it with chemotherapy, if you've got subpopulations of tumor cells, you're going to kill the ones that respond to the drug. The ones that are left behind, they may acquire resistance to the drug, or they're going to be the more aggressive tumor cells. And so that's why when somebody has a recurrence after they've been treated with several rounds of chemotherapy or radiation therapy, that the tumors tend to become more and more aggressive over time. The tough guys survive. And so it gets harder and harder to treat after people have failed several rounds of therapy. And that's also why, if we can identify tumors, when we can surgically resect them all, when we can cut them out, those patients have the best prognosis. So, any other questions about the pathobiology? Okay. So if you look at the lifetime probability of developing cancer, so this is developing cancer at any time in your life. This is for men alive in the United States between 1998 and 2000. The lifetime probability of developing cancer at any site is 50%. Now, that doesn't mean that you will die as a result of that cancer. That's just the probability that you will develop cancer. You can see prostate cancer at the top of the list, 1 in 6. Here's lung cancer, 1 in 13. Colorectal, 1 in 17. If we look at the same for women, lifetime risk, 1 in 3. Breast cancer, most common, 1 in 7, followed by lung cancer and colorectal cancer. Okay. What are ways to reduce cancer risk? We said 1/3 of cancers can be prevented. Don't smoke. It's evil. There are very simple ways to reduce cancer risk. Do we do them?
Exercise?
Mm-hmm. Sunscreen?
High volume diet.
High fiber diet, you mean? Yeah. If we look, here's tobacco use. So this is an interesting correlation. If you look at per capita cigarette consumption versus time, look at lung cancer death rates in men. There's a lag, and that's the time that's required for the tumors to develop as a result of chronic exposure to the carcinogens in cigarette smoke. Mm-hmm.
Not to say anything about, you know, cigarette smoking lung cancer, but didn't before the increase in diagnostic capability is pretty great over the time period of the graph, right?
Well, actually, lung cancer is one of the cancers that we do the worst job at detecting lung cancer at an early stage. That's one of the reasons why lung cancer mortality is so high, is because we basically have no good tools to detect lung cancer early. Typically, the way lung cancer is detected is people are coughing, they might be having trouble breathing, and so they go to the doctor, and then they're worked up, and then we find a stage 4 lung cancer, and 6 months later, they're dead. So, you know, I mean, I don't think, and there are cancers where you could argue that our ability to diagnose it earlier has led to an apparent increase in incidence, and we'll look at that with prostate cancer in particular. And I think we could reasonable people do disagree about, do we do more harm than good in screening for prostate cancer? But I don't think that you could argue that this increase is due to an increase in our ability to better detect lung cancer. And I think also, if we were to break down the per capita cigarette consumption by gender, we would see that women started smoking later than men. And you see that lung cancer rates rise for women later. And the delay in the incidence of lung cancer in women parallels exactly the delay in when women started smoking. Yeah. Is there a question in the back? No? Okay. Eating 5 or more servings of fruits and vegetables a day can reduce your risk of developing many types of cancers. This is looking at the percentage of the population who report that they eat 5 or more servings of fruit and vegetable a day. And you can see that despite a number of campaigns to try and increase awareness of this, it hasn't had much of an effect on what people self-report. If you go to the cafeteria at MD Anderson, they give you free fruit. So there are a lot of physicians at MD Anderson who, if you look in their briefcase, you'll find a rotten apple. It is, and vitamins as well.
So people are necessarily not deciding to go for 3 more bananas first, either supplement, is that necessary?
You know, I don't know, actually, in terms of the protective effect associated with taking a multivitamin supplement.
Or depending on a lot of cereal.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to your question. Yeah.
I just understanding cancer last year, and
Okay.
Body
blow
power.
Uh-huh.
The part of it is that having that much more than you realize to your digestive tract cleans out a lot of the dead cells, prevents voids, and then also the gas that's created by these vegetables and the breakdown of the sugar between the fiber creates the gas themselves.
Okay. So if we look back historically at what has happened with cancer in our country, if we go back to 1971, President Nixon, in his State of the Union address, requested $100 million for cancer research. And he signed what was called the National Cancer Act into law. And he said at that time, "I hope in years ahead we'll look back on this action today as the most significant one taken during my administration." If we take a look at what's happened to mortality rates by cause in the United States, this is going back to 1950. And here we look at the mortality rate due to heart disease, that due to stroke, that due to pneumonia and influenza, to important infectious diseases and cancer. You can see that heart disease was by far the leading killer in the U.S. in 1950. If we fast forward to 2001, you can see how much mortality rates associated with heart disease and stroke have dropped. Same thing is true with pneumonia and influenza. But if we look at cancer, actually the age-adjusted mortality rate associated with cancer hasn't dropped over 50 years. There have been a number of cancers where there have been significant improvements in both treatment and diagnosis, leukemias, for example, but the overall age-adjusted mortality rate hasn't changed. This breaks it down by site. This is looking at the mortality rate over time for several different types of cancer, and this is in men. And here again, we see that dramatic increase in lung cancer mortality rate. And we'll get to prostate cancer in a minute. Here you see this little blip of increase followed by a decrease in prostate cancer death rates. Here we look at the same for women, and look at lung cancer. You can see lung cancer rates, they increased later for women. Here we're looking at uterine cancer decrease. This is primarily because of better screening. Here we look at incidence rates. Okay, look what happened with prostate cancer right here in the early 1990s. And that was in fact due to use of screening tools. And so we started looking and we found a bunch more prostate cancer. Okay, and when the PSA screening test became widely introduced, we saw this increase in the incidence of prostate cancer. Now, is that a real increase in incidence of prostate cancer? That's an apparent increase in incidence because we're looking more, now we're finding it more. Okay. And here's the same data for women. Again, you can see lung cancer incidence rates increasing. This looks at the five-year survival rates for cancer. This is looking at data from 1975, 1984, and between 1992 and 1999. So remember the five-year survival rate? That's the fraction of people who will be alive 5 years following their diagnosis. For all sites, you can see it's gone up a little bit. And if you take a look at lung cancer, very small amounts of progress, primarily, again, because we detect it late. Look at prostate cancer, though, 67, 75, 98. And a lot of that is better early detection. Again, as we'll see, people disagree about, are we doing more harm than good with screening for prostate cancer? If we look at the National Cancer Institute, this is a part of the National Institutes of Health that is devoted to research to eliminate suffering and death due to cancer by 2015. The director of the National Cancer Institute is a guy named Dr. Andy von Eschenbach. He is a urologist who was formerly on the faculty at the MD Anderson Cancer Center and left to go direct the NCI. I think it's been about 2.5, maybe 3 years now that he has been at NCI. This was a relatively controversial change in the mission statement of the National Cancer Institute. You know, 2015 is 9 years away from now. And if we look at the relatively slow progress that's been made over the last 50 years, there was a lot of debate about, is this a mission that we have a hope of attaining? And he doesn't say eliminate cancer. He says eliminate suffering and death due to cancer. And really the idea behind that is that we need to improve early detection. If we let patients get to stage 3 and stage 4, we don't have effective therapies, and over the last 50 years we haven't been able to develop effective therapies. We do have effective therapies for earlier lesions. The budget request in 2004 was about, there are some zeros missing here, was about $6 billion for the National Cancer Institute. And their current budget is just over $6 billion a year. So why is early detection so important? We looked, I think, at this graph earlier. This shows the 5-year survival rate for 5 different types of cancers. This is the survival rate when the cancer is confined to the local organ site when it's detected. This is the survival rate when there's been a regional metastasis. Regional metastasis means if we've got a cancer that arises in the cheek, maybe it has metastasized to the bone surrounding. If there's been a distant metastasis, it's gone to a distant organ site. And you can see how precipitously the survival rates drop when you've got distant metastasis. And that the 5-year survival rates are in the 80 to 90% ballpark when we've got a tumor that's confined to the local organ site. If we've got a precancer, the 5-year survival rates are basically 100%. So if we can identify things at an early stage, then we can, if we detect it at a precancerous stage, we can prevent cancer from developing by treating it. Or we can, if we can identify it at a microinvasive stage, we can treat it basically and know that we'll have a good cure rate. And so the approach to identify more cancers early is to do what's called screening. When you go to the doctor and you're sick, you have symptoms, and he or she does a diagnostic test to determine what disease you have, that is a process called diagnosis. We're working you up because you have symptoms. Okay? That's very different than the process of screening. The process of screening means I take people that don't have symptoms of disease, and I'm going to give them a test to see if they might be at risk for having the disease, and they might need further workup to confirm the presence of the disease. So screening means I take everybody in this room and I give them a test to see if they might be at higher risk for having cancer and maybe would benefit from additional diagnostic workup. They don't have symptoms, I'm just testing them. So it's the use of simple tests in a healthy population. And the goal is to identify individuals who have disease but don't yet have symptoms. So we'll see with lung cancer, with ovarian cancer, by the time you get symptoms, the cancer is at a very advanced stage. So with ovarian cancer, for example, there's a saying that ovarian cancer whispers. And what that means is that women have sort of a vague sense of abdominal discomfort. Maybe they'll go to the doctor and they'll say, you know, my pants, they just feel a little tight. I've been dieting. I don't seem to be losing weight. And their physician might say, you know, you're getting older, these things happen. But really it's associated with having ovarian cancer. And by the time that you start having symptoms so severe that everybody agrees something is wrong, you're at a stage where treatments are no longer effective. So screening is giving healthy people tests to see if they have disease, but they don't yet have symptoms. Screening can do good. Screening can identify people early when treatments are effective. Screening can also do harm, though. Screening should only be undertaken when, first of all, the effectiveness of the screening test has been demonstrated, and we've got resources to screen everybody who might be at risk. We have resources to take those people who have a positive screening test and follow them up appropriately to confirm the diagnosis and to treat them. And the last bullet on the slide is very, very important. Draw a big box around this one because it's really the key. Screening for rare diseases is hard. And we'll see why both today and a week from Tuesday in class. If I've got a rare disease like ovarian cancer, for example, I have to have a really, really accurate test in order for screening to do more good than harm. So if the disease prevalence is very, very low, then the test has to be a really, really good test. Okay. Which cancers do we screen for right now? Routinely, we screen for four. We do mammography to screen for female breast cancer. We use the Pap smear to screen for cervical cancer and its precursors in women. In men, we screen for prostate cancer using two tests, a blood test called the serum PSA, and then a rectal exam to feel for enlargement of the prostate. And then we screen for colorectal cancer using a couple of tests, the fetal occult blood test to look for blood and stool specimens, and then a couple of imaging techniques to look at the colon and the rectum, one called flexible sigmoidoscopy and another called colonoscopy. There are usually recommendations that are made by professional groups about when you should have these different screening tests, and there's some controversies about them. This is guidelines from the American Cancer Society for screening for breast cancer in women. So here they say, they recommend yearly mammograms starting at age 40 and continuing for as long as a woman is in good health. If I've got congestive heart failure and my life expectancy is very short, probably I don't need to have a screening mammogram anymore. A clinical breast exam should be part of a periodic health exam for women in their 20s and 30s about every 3 years, and every year for women 40 and older. Breast self-exam is an option for women starting in their 20s. And then women who are at increased risk because they have a positive family history, a genetic tendency, a BRCA mutation, for example, or a history of breast cancer may want to be screened earlier and more frequently. Okay. So we recommend mammography for women over the age of 40. This looks at how many women actually get a mammogram. This is looking at how many women in the past year have had a mammogram. These are women over 40, shown in black, versus time. So about half, maybe two-thirds, of women who should be getting an annual mammogram are. But if we look at women who have less than a high school education, or importantly, women with no health insurance, you can see these women aren't getting screened at as high rates.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why it has dropped after 2000?
I don't know if it's just statistical fluctuation in the data. I haven't looked at what's happened after. Good question. Yeah. Okay, this is screening guidelines for early detection of colorectal cancer. So beginning at age 50, both men and women should have a fetal occult blood test every year. And then they recommend a variety of imaging techniques and recommend using combined testing with the fetal occult blood test or flexible sigmoidoscopy. And here we look at how many people adhere to this recommendation. So about 1 in 5 people actually adhere to this recommendation. And you can see that, again, the adherence rates are lower for people who have less than a high school education or who don't have health insurance.
Is this, in any, especially for this one, related to the obvious
comfort? I'm sure it is, yeah. There are some new tests. What's the name where they do the fly-through CT? It's virtual colonoscopy. And so one of the problems with colonoscopy is you got to clean out the colon. And so they give you this stuff to drink that's called Go Lightly. So I used to do research in this area when I was a graduate student. And so basically you drink this stuff and then you spend the whole night having diarrhea all night long. And then you come in the next day and your colon is clean enough for them to do colonoscopy. So the nurses in the clinic, they used to wear these little buttons that said Go Lightly Drinking Club. So, you know, not only do you have the discomfort of that, but then you also have the discomfort of the exam. And so I've watched a number of colonoscopies. Typically, patients are given Valium before they have the colonoscopy because of the discomfort that's associated with it. And so, you know, when they're moving the instrument through the colon, you can see the light through the abdomen. I thought it was interesting. But you know, even though they're fairly out of it, when they're awake, but you know, they've got a lot of Valium on board, and so they're relaxed and as comfortable as possible. But when they make the turns with the colonoscope, they'll have cramping associated with it. I mean, it really does look like a fairly uncomfortable procedure. Now, Katie Couric did have hers done on national TV. It's a procedure that does have tremendous benefit, but the discomfort associated with it dissuades people from being screened. Virtual colonoscopy basically is done. You drink the same stuff to cleanse the colon, but then what they do is they do basically spiral CT imaging, and they can reconstruct a 3D view of your colon, so you don't have the discomfort of having this endoscope basically inserted and snaked through the digestive tract. There's also another technique, kind of interesting, where you swallow a little pill, and the pill contains a camera, and the camera basically floats through your digestive tract. Again, you have to take the Go Lightly, because if there's stool there, you're not going to be able to get the pictures that you need. But it's in clinical trials and maybe pending FDA approval for that technique. It's the same idea as doing the spiral CT, except they just do it optically, and you basically swallow this camera, and they can reconstruct the same thing.
That was all four cancers, especially if you don't have a regular doctor that has health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really, that for whatever reason, I don't know if they study, that you're not going to want to go in and help people be looking at those areas of yourself or doing stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of the reasons for people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is that just embarrassment and discomfort is one of the reasons that dissuades people from being screened, but also cost, I think. Is a big factor for people who don't have health insurance. We'll talk about that with cervical cancer in class next time and how different that is in our country and in a developing country in terms of the fraction of your income that if you don't have health insurance that you have to pay to get screened. And if you're healthy, are you willing to do that? You know, if it's $25, it's probably one thing, but if it's $1,000, it's a completely different decision. So, you know, I don't have the study data right in my head right now. In order to get FDA approval, I don't believe that you would be able to get approval if you were less effective than the standard of care, because FDA approval is about two things, safety and efficacy. And you have to have both to get FDA approval. And so spiral CT, I believe, is FDA approved, the little camera that you swallow. I just don't know, and then I don't think it is yet. But you know, they're really doing the same thing that endoscopy is doing. When they do endoscopy, what they're looking for is they're looking for polyps. in the colon that are precursors to colon cancer, and they would remove polyps. Basically, any polyp they find, they're going to remove. And then they'll look at the pathology of it to see, is it a precancerous or a cancerous polyp? If there's cancer there, then they may do more invasive surgery to remove a section of the colon. If you do the spiral CT or you swallow the camera, if they don't find a polyp, you're done. If they do find a polyp, they're going to go back and they're going to do colonoscopy to remove the polyp. Or to, you know, depending on if it's a more advanced lesion, to do a more invasive surgical procedure. But for those people who are fine, it would remove a substantial amount of the discomfort associated with the procedure. Okay. This is looking at flexible sigmoidoscopy. Flexible sigmoidoscopy, basically they're going to use a much shorter endoscope to look at just the distal, the sigmoid colon. So there's less discomfort associated with that. And you can see that there have been great increases in getting people to comply with screening using flexible sigmoidoscopy. Okay, so the last thing that I want to talk about today is, how do I tell if I've got a new screening test? How do I tell if it's effective or not effective? So I want to talk about how we judge efficacy of a screening test. And basically, there's four parameters that we're going to calculate. Okay? We're going to calculate sensitivity and specificity, positive and negative predictive value. If I'm a doctor, typically what I care about is sensitivity and specificity, because they tell me how well the test works. If I'm a patient, I care about positive and negative predictive value because they help me understand if I've got a positive or a negative test result, what are my chances of actually having disease? Okay? So if we look at a screening test for diabetes, there's a questionnaire where you can ask people about their symptoms. And that questionnaire has a sensitivity that ranges from 72 to 78% and a specificity of about 50%. I can also make measurements of capillary blood glucose, and I can look at calling all patients who have a blood glucose level exceeding 140 milligrams per deciliter diabetic, and I'll get one sensitivity and one specificity. Or if I lower the threshold of the test, I'll get a different sensitivity and specificity.
What do sensitivity and specificity mean?
I'm going to tell you that in just 1 second. So, but this is when you go to get information about a test, this is the kind of information you'll find about the performance of the test. So what do sensitivity and specificity mean? So, okay, let's imagine that I have a new screening test and we're looking for lung cancer. Okay? And let's pretend you have lung cancer and you don't have lung cancer. Okay? We're going to give you both the test. So you have lung cancer, you don't. Sensitivity says that he's got lung cancer. What's the probability that I give him a test and it comes back positive? Okay? So if I'm a doctor, I want to know if there's disease there, will my test find it?
You want that to be a high number.
You want that to be a high number. Uh-huh. And so basically sensitivity tells me how well can I correctly detect disease. If I know he has disease and I give him my screening test, the sensitivity tells me the probability that his test will be positive. Okay. Now, if his test comes back negative, that negative result is called a false negative. He's really got disease. I gave him a test. The test came back negative. The test was wrong. Okay? So the false negative rate tells me the percentage of time that the test will come back negative and it's falsely negative. So he gets reassured, but he shouldn't be reassured because he's really got the disease. So the sensitivity can range from 0% to 100%. If the sensitivity is 100% of the time, that means if I give the test to 100 people that have disease, they all have positive test results. If it's 95%, 95 of those 100 people have a positive test result, but 5 of them have a false negative test result. So the sensitivity is also sometimes called 100% minus the false negative rate. Okay. specificity. Now I have my patient who doesn't have disease, and I give him the test. The specificity is that it's the probability that, given I know he does not have disease, that his test will come back negative. Okay? What if his test comes back positive? He doesn't have disease, but he gets kind of freaked out. And we're going to start doing a lot of additional testing on him that will cost money and will be invasive. And so the two types of wrong answers you can get are, I can get a false negative result if his test comes back negative, or I can get a false positive test result if his test comes back positive. Both of them have bad outcomes, right? His cancer keeps growing and we don't do anything for him, and he's all worried because he thinks he has lung cancer and we're doing a bunch of additional testing to follow up and he doesn't really need it. So sensitivity and specificity tell me something about how well the test works. So if I think about a grid, if I'm going to test a group of people, and I know that some of them have disease, and I know that some of them are normal, so I've got some independent way to confirm whether they really do or don't have disease, and I give them all the tests, you can make what's called a 2x2 table. And so I can divide those people up into the people that I know have disease and the people that I know don't have disease. And for each of those two groups of people, I can look at, do they test positive or do they test negative? So if they have disease and they test positive, those kind of results are called true positives. They've got the disease and their test was positive. The right thing happens. Now, if people don't have disease and their test is negative, those people are called true negatives. They don't have disease, their test came back negative, they don't have to worry. Okay? Those are the two right answers that can happen. The two wrong answers that can happen are, you've got the disease, but your test came back negative. You're a false negative. And we don't treat you, but you need treatment. Your disease keeps progressing. The other type of wrong answer is, you don't have disease, but your test came back positive. You're a false positive. And we work you up and we make you worried. So if I add up the true positives and the false negatives, that's just the number of people that have disease. If I add up the false positives and the true negatives, that's just the number of people that don't have disease. If I add all four of those boxes up, that's the total number of people I tested. And these people in this column have a positive test. These people in this column have a negative test. If I go and I test 100 people, I know which ones have disease, which ones don't have disease, and I count my true positives, true negatives, false negatives, I can calculate my sensitivity and my specificity. Okay? The sensitivity is just the number of true positives divided by the number with disease. My specificity is the number of true negatives divided by the number of people without disease. Okay? So we're going to do an example. Let's imagine that we're doing a test called amniocentesis. And I'm going to give my test to 1,000 40-year-old women. And I look at how many children were actually born that had chromosomal abnormalities that this test is looking for. And I look at how many test results were positive and how many were truly positive. I want to now calculate sensitivity and specificity. So what I'd like you to do is fill out that 2x2 table and let's calculate the sensitivity and specificity. So you can do this together if you want, in groups. So I'll go back to the table so you have that in front of you. Thank you. Okay. How many true positives do I have? 25. Okay. How many false negatives do I have? Let's go back here to our example now. So I have 7 false positives because we had 32 positive results. Only 25 of those were truly positive. Okay, so where do my false positives go? They go below the 25. Okay, and then we had 28 children who were born with chromosomal abnormalities, but only 25 of those tested positive, which means I must have 3 tests that were falsely negative. Okay, so where do my false negatives go? Okay, my false negatives are going to go here. And what goes here? 1,000 minus all of these numbers. Okay, so I'm going to have 1,000 minus 7 minus 25 minus 3. Okay, and now we can calculate the sensitivity of our test and the specificity of our test. Our sensitivity is just the true positive divided by the number that had disease. So our sensitivity is going to be 25 divided by 28. Okay, it's going to be 25 divided by 25 and 3. Okay, what's our specificity going to be? Specificity is true negative. So that'll be this number right here, divided by the total number without disease. So it'll be this number divided by this number plus this number. Okay? Because these are the total that don't have disease. Okay? You'll get some practice on the next homework calculating sensitivity and specificity. I just want to say one thing before we quit, which is, what you care about as a patient is not really sensitivity and specificity. What you care about as a patient is predictive value. Predictive value is different than sensitivity and specificity. Predictive value says, if I go into the doctor and I get a positive test result, what is the likelihood that I have the disease? We'll learn how to calculate that next time. I'll go through the rest of the slides next time. Yes, you should. Give it to Abed, and she'll be sure you get the extra credit.